Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Misfit Faith podcast. This is episode 30, and I'm your host, Jason Stellman. Our number is 949-354-2483. If you've got a question, if you have a topic you want me to discuss, if there's something I've said you'd like to push back on, give me a call, leave me a voicemail, and I will play it on the air. Before we jump in, I want to talk a little bit about my mentoring work that I do. I just started mentoring a new client this last couple of weeks, and I have to say, mentoring is perhaps the most rewarding aspects to all of the work I do. I just love it. I love sort of drawing from my own experiences, many of them failures, some of them successes, but just drawing from my own experience in sort of spiritual deconstruction and reconstruction, navigating spiritual identity crises, figuring out what we believe, whether it matters that much what we believe. There's nothing I love more than sort of, you know, taking somebody by the hand and helping them walk through whatever it is they're trying to figure out and to encourage them along the way. And so if you are somebody who is struggling in your faith, struggling to determine who you are spiritually, what you believe, where you belong, if that's you, then let me know, and I would love to try to help. If you go to jasonstellman.com/mentoring, you can find out more. And also, all of my patrons who are patrons to the tune of $25 a month get a whole lot of rewards, and I'll talk about that later, but they get a whole lot of rewards with every tier from $1, $5, I think the next one is 10, then 25 or something. There are a lot of rewards associated with each of those tiers. The $25 reward gets all of the previous tier's rewards plus a free 30-minute phone call with me. So if you're not sure you want to pull the trigger, but you're intrigued enough to maybe give it a shot, then if you become a patron of $25, you get a free 30-minute phone call, and you can decide after that whether mentoring is something that you'd like to pursue further. All right, on with the show. I began last week a new series here on the Misfit Faith podcast titled Vaticant, and the subtitle is Catholicism Without All the Uplifting Parts. And what this is an attempt on my part to bring influences like divine nonviolence, religionless Christianity, quantum theory, and radical theology to bear upon my own Catholicism, in an attempt to both bolster Catholicism's already existing sacramental devotion to the physical world, but also to challenge its nitpickiness and to challenge its occasional triumphalism. As I shared last week, I've spent the last few years reading pretty extensively from the likes of John Caputo, Brad Jurczak, Brian McLaren, Peter Rollins, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I'm reading Dharmad Omurchu's book, Quantum Theology, whom I'm going to interview for this show for an upcoming episode coming up here in the near future, as well as, you know, Diana Butler Bass, Peter Enns, and various other writers who would probably fall on somewhere close to the progressive end of the spectrum when it comes to Christianity. And what I'm seeking to do in this new series is to integrate and incorporate some of these seemingly disparate ideas that I've been reading about and talking to you all about into something of a whole cloth, into something that is uniquely my own and that is informed by my own Catholicism, which itself is quite Chestertonian, as I'm sure you are aware. And last week we began with the first installment, which was called Avoiding the Void. And what I was seeking to show was that, you know, we as humans feel within ourselves a lack or a void that we then almost immediately externalize, right? So this awareness or this realization that we're lacking something at the core of our being is often stillborn. You know, this realization is almost dead on arrival because we immediately, upon sensing some lack within ourselves, we externalize that and we project it onto some sort of scapegoat. Right. So we take all of our inner frustrations that we don't know what to do with and we externalize them and project them onto some community. You know, I used the example last week of minorities or immigrants. And so they are made to bear the burden of our own inner frustrations. And so we say things like, you know, once we neutralize that threat over there, then we will be able to, you know, recapture this golden age, this utopian ideal, and all will be well. Hashtag make America great again. Now, this isn't just a secular or political phenomenon, although it certainly rears its head in those spheres, but this is a religious phenomenon as well. And that's what I want to talk about in this second installment, which I'm calling The Gospel According to Satan. And so to sort of unpack this, let's go back to the very beginning. Let's go back to the creation narrative in the book of Genesis, chapter 3. As you know, Genesis is the first chapter, or rather the first book of the Bible, of the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible. And we're introduced in chapter 3 to this cunning serpent. And this cunning serpent confronts Eve, and eventually Adam as well, in the Garden of Eden, and makes a proposal to them. Now, of course, none of this is contingent on whether or not this is literal history. Some of you listening to this might believe that the serpent and Adam and Eve and the whole story of the apple and all of that is literal history. And others of you may see it as more mythological or metaphorical or figurative. It doesn't really matter. You can land anywhere you want on that question because this doesn't really touch upon that. That does not really bear all that significantly upon what we're going to talk about. So whether you understand this metaphorically or whether you understand it literally and historically, the serpent comes to Eve and he makes this proposal. He says, you know, there is something amazing for you just over the horizon. Because remember, we saw last week, this utopian ideal that we want, we always have to postulate that it's just around the corner, that it's just out of reach. It's just over the horizon. And so the serpent comes to Eve and says, this amazing utopian ideal is just down the road. It's just over the horizon. And this thing that's standing in your way of achieving it is this forbidden fruit, and more particularly, this prohibition on God's part of your eating the fruit from the forbidden tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But the serpent says to Eve, if you would only transgress the prohibition, you would be whole, you would be godlike, and you would be complete. And so he says, has God really said you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? God knows that in the day you eat of this fruit, you will be like God. You will be whole. You will be complete. The void and the lack will be overcome. Now, I hinted earlier that, you know, perhaps the real problem is not the manner by which we're seeking to avoid the void, but the quest itself. And that's kind of how I ended my last reflection in podcast number 29. You know, in other words, is it possible that our mistake is not that we're trying to heal ourselves with all the wrong remedies, but perhaps the mistake is that we're trying to heal ourselves at all? You see, the assumption that's doing the heavy lifting here is that any hole, any void, any lack that we feel is obviously an aberration. It's obviously something that has interrupted illegitimately our otherwise blissful condition, and our job is to overcome it, right? And so that desire on our part, the desire on Eve's part, the desire on the part of so many people today to overcome the lack, to avoid the void, to get that sense of completeness and wholeness that we want, the underlying assumption there is that this lack is unnatural, that this void is something that has intruded illegitimately into our lives, and it's something that we need to get over. There was a time before we had this lack, and there will be a time in the future when we won't have it anymore, and now we're experiencing this kind of parenthetical speed bump, and we have to somehow find a way through this lack to avoid the void. Well, turns out that notion is serpentine and, well, satanic. And from the look of it, so are most of our churches. What am I saying? Our churches are synagogues of Satan? Well, hold on. Think about it. You know, after all, what is the message that's proclaimed from the majority of American pulpits Sunday after Sunday? It's some version of this, right? You have a hole in your heart that needs to be filled, but you're trying to fill it with all the wrong things. Sex, drugs, or alcohol can't fill the void. Only Jesus can. I mean, I can't tell you how many times as a young believer in sort of megachurch Southern California evangelicalism, I heard some version of this evangelistic appeal to the lost, whether at church or at a crusade or on the street evangelizing or wherever it was. It was always the assumption that the void and the lack, that God-shaped hole, is not something you should have to put up with. And you've been seeking to fill that lack and plug that hole with all these different things, whether it's a relationship, whether it's money, whether it's fame or power or drugs or alcohol or sex, whatever it might be, you're trying to fill that void. And that's the right thing to do, but you're just not doing it right. Jesus is the only one who can fill that void for you. And I'm sure for many of you listening, this is very, very familiar territory. In other words, the problem isn't the vending machine. The problem is that you're pushing the wrong buttons. And so this rather typical gospel message, and I'm putting that in scare quotes, it leaves the entire underlying satanic and serpentine structure safely and securely in place while only tinkering with the details, right? And so this gospel message that we hear, it doesn't call into question any of the assumptions of this appeal that says you're looking for your fulfillment in all the wrong places. You need to look for your fulfillment in Jesus. This approach to the gospel doesn't question anything that the serpent told Eve. It just questions the details of that proposal and the manner in which that sense of godlike wholeness and completeness and well-being can be found. And so, yes, we are told, you are correct to assume that this lack that you feel is an unwelcome intruder. And yes, you're also correct in seeking to eliminate it. What you're trying to do is right, but you're just doing it wrong. So if you punch in the proper code, the vending machine will indeed dispense the sense of wholeness and well-being that you desire, and your lack will disappear. And so the way that the American church formulates the gospel and presents it to unbelievers is fundamentally consistent with what Eve was told in Genesis 3 by the serpent, that you can achieve this sense of well-being and wholeness and avoid the void and all of that if you just turn to Jesus. And for some reason, the fact that this entire outlook was originally promulgated by the devil doesn't seem to bother us in the slightest.
We all want to have sex with our mothers, at least according to the Oedipus complex. The story is a young guy wants to sleep with his mother. His father gets in the way, and so he kills the father to be with his mother. He thinks this is going to be wonderful, but it turns out to be a curse. So what does this story mean? Well, for Freud, the mother could be seen to represent a return to some sort of oceanic oneness. The return to the mother is an attempt to get back to some experience before alienation, some experience of pure bliss. And the father represents anything that gets in the way of that. So the moral of the story is, be careful what you wish for. If you actually break through all the prohibitions of society and actually get what your heart desires, you'll find out that it's not a blessing, but actually a curse. Well, the Jewish tradition also starts with a type of Oedipus story. You have two people in a garden, walking around doing whatever they want. And then there is a prohibition. And behind the prohibition is a tree with fruit. Do not eat the fruit from the tree. Well, Adam and Eve think to themselves, what would it taste like? They break the prohibition. They think it's going to be wonderful, but it's an absolute disaster. Both of these stories give us an existential insight into what it means to be human. That all of us, to a greater or lesser extent, experience a gap between what we have and what we would like to have. And we try to close this gap in all manner of ways, trying to grasp at that sacred object that we think we need more than anything else. For Freud, there was a voice that would demand we achieve this, and it's called the superego. It's the voice that tells you that if only you're nicer to your parents, or have more sex, or go out with the right person, or have enough money, then everything will be great. And we tend to believe that if only we do what the superego demands, then we'd be happy. But in psychoanalysis, part of the challenge is actually to realize that the big other, this superego, doesn't exist. That actually the more we try to obey it, the more unhappy we become, the more depressed we become, and the more difficult life is. And the challenge is to, in a sense, get rid of this superego voice. Now, in the story of Adam and Eve, you also have a type of superego, and it's called the serpent. The serpent is this voice that says, if you eat this fruit, then you will be whole and complete. Then you will be like God. And of course, to be like God traditionally means to lack the lack. And people think that we need to obey this voice, that we need to do what the serpent says, to try to achieve those things in life that we think will bring back that oceanic experience. But any community that tries to do that is, technically speaking, a satanic community. Any church that tells you you have to be something or get somewhere is technically in league with this devil. In theology, the challenge is to exorcise this voice, to get rid of it. And the technology of exorcism is grace. Grace is the idea that you are accepted. To experience grace is to experience the idea that you are accepted for who you are. To accept that acceptance. It isn't about saying, oh, I'll give you a second chance to get to your ideal. It's about saying there is no ideal you need to get to. You're fine the way you are, or rather you're not fine the way you are, and that's okay. But ironically, it's actually this experience of not having to strive for some ideal that helps transformation take place. It's like quicksand. The more we move and the more we strive, the deeper we sink. But when we're able to stop, then we stop sinking. Then real transformation can happen. think about AA. In AA, there are 12 steps. But before the 12 steps, there's step zero. And what's that? It's being in a room of people who accept you just the way you are. In a room where you can say your truth, where you won't be judged, where you don't actually have to change. It might take you weeks or months or even years before you're able to accept the acceptance in that room. But once you're able to do that, once you're able to realize that you're accepted and you don't have to do anything, that's when change becomes possible, when the 12 steps actually become effective. The offense of grace is that you're accepted as you are. You don't need to strive for some ideal. And in that acceptance, you will find life, freedom, and transformation.
Hey Jason, I'm a big fan. My name's John. I've followed your journey over the years and a lot of it resonates with me. I grew up and came to faith in evangelicalism, and at some point in my 20s I became a fire-breathing Calvinist. I spent my 30s being fully involved in two very unhealthy and toxic churches, which among other things led me to have quite a paradigm shift. Through that process I found myself entering into the Eastern Orthodox Church. A lot of my attraction to Eastern Christianity seems similar to what you've articulated with your draw towards aspects of Catholicism. I was attracted to Orthodoxy's deep historic rootedness in tradition. I was drawn to its liturgy, its emphasis on mystery, and a more gracious and non-juridical view of salvation. If I'm honest, a lot also has to do with with the aesthetics of it. I love smells, bells, and iconography. I'm also probably not the most pious or dogmatic Christian, and truth be told, I often resonate more with ex-evangelicals and agnostics. Over the years, I've realized that my shift has left me with quite a cognitive dissonance about God. I used to think of God as an external force who personally intervened in my daily life. But I now see God as a mystery who works through people and natural means. There's also the idea that God doesn't save us from our pain or circumstantial afflictions as much as he identifies with us in them. And this, of course, is more nuanced, sober, and for lack of a better word, adult. Scripture and tradition reinforce this, but it's a far distance from the emphasis on God who loves me and has a great plan for my life that I embraced as an evangelical teenager, or the God who predestined me before the foundations of the universe as a Calvinist. I guess what I'm saying is that I found myself not really expecting much from God as an external force. My shift has led me to lose the interventionist God of my youth. If and or when I pray, it has more to do with connecting to mystery than it does expecting or asking God to intervene in some way. Again, perhaps this is good and more sober, but if I'm honest, that often leaves me feeling disappointed and hollow. I know that Christians are supposed to be the intervening body of Christ in the world, but sometimes I miss my sky daddy, busty Jesus God. I'm well aware of the platitudes and pushbacks on the observations that I'm making, but I'd be curious to get your thoughts. What can you say about the loss of an external interventionist God? I thought this might be good for your new Vatican series. Thanks in advance for your consideration.
Thank you, John, for the call. You know, I certainly agree with you when it comes to the aesthetics. You know, I am an aesthete to the core. And so even though you're technically not supposed to take things like beauty into consideration when picking a church, for some reason, I can't help it. I am very much affected by aesthetics. Now, I'm a total Westerner as well, unlike you. And so I kind of prefer stained glass and statues to icons. It goes back for me to, I remember I was traveling to Africa when I was 18 years old, and I was with two of my friends. We had a layover in Brussels, and we sort of had the entire day to sort of hang out and eat, you know, Belgian waffles, or as they're called there, waffles. And we happened upon St. Michael's Cathedral in downtown Brussels, and we went in, and it was really my first kind of foray as a sort of thinking adult into anything Catholic. You know, I'd been to Mass a few times as a kid with friends or whatever, but it never really was on my radar. and stumbled into St. Michael's Cathedral and was just in awe of the beauty, of the majesty, of the memory. Everything about it was just sublime. And I was just sort of, my breath was taken away. It helped that there was, for some reason, some classical orchestra doing a rehearsal, perhaps for some recital or something that was coming up that night. I'm not sure, but there's all this, I mean, the beautiful sounds and all this beautiful architecture and furniture and everything really made a profound effect on me. And I can look back at my journals that I kept when I was living in Europe about, oh, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years later. I'm still talking about this kind of haunting desire for a some sort of Catholic, you know, mindset or some sort of Catholic juju, you know, that I wanted as part of my DNA because of how profoundly affected I have been by it. I also agree with you on the whole participatory point that you made. You know, I love emphasizing the idea that, you know, God has emptied himself out as an offering upon the face of the world. And he's poured out his spirit upon all flesh to the point that heaven is empty because his body is here. And it is us as we seek to be the hands and feet of God to the world, as we seek to be the body of Christ and to be Jesus to the world and embody this invisible God to the stranger. Now, on the point you made about kind of the non-interventionist God versus, you know, sky genie Jesus, I'd obviously rather have the latter, you know, and be able to snap my fingers and have him at my beck and call. But I just don't think it works that way. You know, if you think about the cross, what we learn from the cross, if the cross is at all central to our faith, which I should certainly think it is, what we learn from the cross is that God, on the one hand, does not intervene to stop evil or to frustrate man's intent, even if that intent is wicked, right? Peter, you know, took out his sword and started swinging it in the garden when they came to arrest Jesus, and Jesus rebuked him and said, put your sword in its sheath. Don't you know I could summon, you know, 12 legions of angels to deliver me from this if I wanted to? But it's for this cause I came into the world. But we also learn from the cross that although God does not necessarily intervene to stop evil or to frustrate man's plans, at the same time, he's not distant, but he participates in human suffering, which is what the cross is all about. Regardless of whether you think that, you know, this is sort of the orthodox account of Jesus as a God-man, a divine person with a human and divine nature hypostatically united in a single person, or whether you think that, you know, Jesus was just teaching us something about God and he knew something that the rest of us didn't and still don't, sadly. Regardless of where you fall on that, the fact of the matter is that, you know, at the very least, what the cross teaches us is that God is not distant from our suffering, but he participates in it, in the person of Christ, to the most profound degree, right? I mean, there Jesus is, you know, whether he's a son of God or whether he's God incarnate or whether he's a prophet, whatever, he is throwing himself, casting himself headlong into the throes of human suffering, of evil, and of suffering evil at the hands of wicked men. And so, on the one hand, we see from the cross that God does not intervene to stop evil. On the other hand, we see that God is not distant, but that he, in the most profound and personal way imaginable, he participates in human suffering in the person of Christ. Now, if the standard evangelical view were correct, you know, which says that, you know, God, as you put it, you know, is kind of like a sky genie who just shows up and sort of snaps to attention when we ring our little bell and summon him, that would cause more problems than it's worth, if that view were correct. Because if that view were correct, and if God were that imminent and involved in every personal, you know, crisis or issue that we are facing, if that were the case, if that evangelical view were correct, think of all the problems it would cause. Think of the ramifications of God either choosing to or choosing not to intervene in the way that we often, you know, portray him as doing. You know, no retreat into divine mystery would be enough to explain why he killed that innocent kid over there, but had the time to help you with your math test. Right? I mean, the way we talk about answered prayer is just almost insulting and so trivializing of the suffering that so many people are going through. I mean, I know people whose kids are dying of cancer. And for you to say that God helped you find a good parking spot at Costco on a Sunday afternoon, that is, you know, insulting and trivializing of the suffering that so many people are going through in their lives. At the end of the day, I feel like belief in God is intended to inspire us earthlings to serve, to care for, to love, and to empty ourselves out in sacrificial Christ-likeness on behalf of the other, as though everything depends on us. Because it kind of does. But then, if the Lakers sign LeBron James in free agency, I just may have to change my mind about all of this. All right. Just about out of time, but before I let you go, I do need a minute.
Now, it's time for Jason Needs a Minute.
I am tired of trucks. I've had enough. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, personal trucks like F-150s, although I hate those too. And, you know, I consider them Trump vehicles in the same way that corn nuts and chewing tobacco are Trump food and Trump habits, respectively. No, I'm talking about big work trucks like semis. Just the other day, I'm driving with my kids and we're on one of those, you know, one lane in each direction roads. And I'm behind this massive semi carrying like four or five boulders that are strapped to the bed of it. And it is followed by another massive semi that's also carrying four or five massive boulders, you know, the size of small cars, strapped to the bed of the truck. Now, I kept thinking to myself, this is unacceptable. You know, what are those for? Like, what reason could there, you know, possibly be for these trucks to need to carry these massive boulders from wherever they were to wherever they're going? Like, who needs these things? Now, maybe you're thinking, you know, maybe they're being transported to some work site, you know, where they'll be crushed down into smaller rocks and used for a construction project or something. But here, I have an idea. Hey, either find rocks closer to where you're building or build closer to where the fucking rocks are, okay? I mean, this is the real reason, by the way, to shop and buy local. Because when you don't, I get stuck behind the damn trucks needed to haul your shit all over the place. So here's my proposal, okay? There should be an entire highway system just for trucks. And it should be somewhere where the rest of us don't have to see it or even be reminded of its existence. Now, how will this work? Where will it be? Who will pay for it, you ask? Well, I don't know. It's not my job to figure these things out. I'm the visionary, okay? I come up with the ideas and I let other people execute them. So just build it underground or something. I don't know. I'm sure Elon Musk has some extra subterranean tunnels lying around he could lease out. And take the funds to do this from all the tax cut money Trump just handed out to all his rich constituents. They don't need it.
This has been Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, that is our show. Thanks for listening, everybody. Just as a reminder, if you are benefiting from my work, whether here on the podcast or elsewhere, you can visit patreon.com/Jason Stellman to find out various ways to support me and the various rewards that are associated with those different levels of support. Our number is 949-354-2483. If you've got a question, give me a call, leave me a voicemail. Also, visit jasonstellman.com. It's my website. You'll find blog posts there. You'll find the podcast lives there as well. And also, if you go to my website and then go to the shop tab on the right, you'll find my audiobook, Misfit Faith for Sale, as well as the Misfit Faith video course, which consists of 7 videos, roughly an hour long each, where I took a group of people through my book, Misfit Faith, and now I am offering that course for sale as an a la carte item on the website for $25. And lastly, if you can, leave me an iTunes review. Go to iTunes, find my podcast, leave me a review. That's easy, doesn't cost you anything, but it really helps as a way to kind of get the word out. So anyway, that's all, folks. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.